everybody, and welcome to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Today, we will call this meeting to order. And with that, if we could start with the roll, Ms. Hansen.
Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Long time no see. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto, I don't think has joined us yet. Representative Rep.
I actually just did as you were saying my name.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins. Thank you, I see Representative Robbins. Representative Sandell.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you, sir. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. A quorum is present. And with that, would anyone like to move the minutes for 2-22-22?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. We will then go ahead and move the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. With that, members, we have on the agenda today HF 3380, Representative Hansen's bill. Representative Hansen, would you like to move that HF 3380 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
All right, perfect. All right, well, now that we have the bill before us, Representative Hansen, would you like to go ahead and speak to your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I come to you today with a bill that will have a huge impact on the lives of children throughout Minnesota, and I'm really excited to talk to you about it. You know, the vast majority of people agree that foster care placement should be a last resort for children who cannot remain safely at their home with their primary caregivers. We know that children experiencing foster care are at a higher risk of negative outcomes later in life, particularly when they remain in foster care for extended period of time or if they age out without permanency. Preservation of a child's family and their connections to relatives and kin, it leads to improved child welfare outcomes for children and their families, which in turn can improve these long-term outcomes, not just for these children, but for generations. This bill seeks to do a lot of things. For example, it seeks to reduce the likelihood of unnecessary removals through greater court oversight and prevention efforts. It provides systemic and practice changes through an equity lens at multiple decision points. It improves the opportunities for families to ensure the safety of their children prior to them being removed from their homes. It places a greater emphasis on keeping children with their families rather than non-relative providers. And it includes a cultural definition of kin. Compared to white children, American Indian and Indigenous children were 16.4 times more likely, and African American and Black children were 2.4 times more likely to be removed from their homes. And with children of two or more races, they were 6.8 times more likely to experience out-of-home care in 2020. This legislation is going to impact all children in the child welfare system. However, given these numbers and the overrepresentation of Black and African American children in the child welfare system, we expect that this legislation would disproportionately benefit Black and African American children, as well as Indigenous children and families to whom ICWA does not apply. HF 3380 is intended to maintain family connections and relationships through improve family preservation and these relative placement efforts. Like I said, this bill does so many things, and just a few of the additional pieces I want to highlight are that it strengthens that legal requirement for removing a child from their home by requiring that the details and description of actual agency efforts are in the court record. It includes that the assessment of safety, as well as other alternative family or kin-based arrangements, were included in those court orders when there is an order for removal. It strengthens and clarifies that relative searches, the engagement and consideration process, the placement requirements for local agency staff, and the court oversight of local agency efforts in this area are updated, modernized, and reflect the best practices that we know exist. This bill will clarify that the safety plans and out-of-home placements must be individualized, and I can't emphasize that enough, because individualized care and support produces better outcomes, and it ensures that the court reviews these plans to consider whether these services and actions were culturally appropriate, individualized, and selected collaboratively with the child and family. Members, I could talk about this bill all day. It's very important to me and to a number of people in our communities, but I have DHS here to answer any questions that you might have. I would also direct members to the committee documents that were submitted to see a breakdown of all of the changes that this bill proposes. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to members or DHS if they have any comments to make as well. You're on mute, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Partly my button does not want to push here. I appreciate that. I am actually going to briefly, before we move on to the testifiers, I am going to briefly hand the gavel over to Chair Schultz for a few minutes, because I need to attend to something, but that way we can keep us moving. All right, with that, our Chair Schultz, I will hand it to you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. So the first testifier we have is Angie Tice. Are you with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm Angie Tice, and I am the Association of Minnesota Counties Child Wellbeing Policy Analyst here today representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. In a state supervised county administered system, it will be the human service administrators that implement this language. I'm here today to say that we share and support the goals of the bill and are committed to working with the author and with the department to make the necessary changes. We have a meeting later this week and would like to call attention to a couple of areas that we have questions about, specifically around the intersection of the language with law enforcement, legislating best practices, and clarifying actions, which also leads to a presumption that we have an appropriate service array across the state of Minnesota that can support families before out-of-home placement is needed. And with that, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Tice. And I assume, I don't know if Rep. Hansen wants to respond to that. I'm assuming you will work with the each other and DHS on those issues. Representative Hansen.
Of course, Madam Chair, the more the merrier. The better we can make our bills, the better the families and children who are impacted by them will be.
Okay, are there questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I don't think that you would get any disagreement about the need to protect those that are most vulnerable amongst us. I do have several questions, and I understand that this bill is moving to judiciary, so some of those probably are pertinent to that. And Madam Chair, I guess the first question, I understand that this bill does or has had a fiscal note requested of it. Do you happen to know when that might be coming to us or the next committee, or what is the status of that?
Once we have the fiscal note, which I don't have the status of, I don't know if Rep. Hansen knows, we will bring that fiscal note back to this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, in the body of the bill, you outline a number of changes in terms of the responsibility by county workers in terms of placement, particularly a couple I point out to you. One is that you are now requiring a diligent effort as opposed to any efforts. But then you're also suggesting that a higher burden is actually placed on counties if they don't demonstrate a reasonable effort to avoid an out-of-family placement. What is your opinion in terms of whether or not that could cause the potential for litigation between county services and the families that are involved?
Rep. Hansen.
Thank you, Representative Albright, for the question. I am I'm self-proclaimed not an attorney, so I do not want to step too far into this, but we do have some staff from DHS and Child and Family Services who may have a really great answer for you. And if they don't, I commit to finding the answer for you and coming back. As you know, my background is in social work, and speaking with, you know, others who work in this field, there are changes that are needed, and we're looking forward to that. But I'm not privy to having the answers to answer a legal question like that. But I would love to get the professionals involved who can.
I don't know if you need to express your opinion or speculate on this that you may not know, but we do have Ms. Baum here from DHS if she wants to respond to Representative Albright's question.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Autumn Baum, and I am the legislative lead for Child Safety and Permanency at the Department of Human Services. I cannot answer the question related to the likelihood of litigation just off the top of my head. I'm happy to look into the question some further, but I do not know how this particular piece would impact litigation. I'm sorry.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Baum, in addition to that, I find there's a notation that said the courts would be barred from finding an agency made reasonable efforts to prevent placement based on claims that no service or effort would have been had made it safe for a child to remain in the home. What if the family objects?
Ms. Baum?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, could you refer to line numbers in the bill just so I can know precisely where you're looking?
I will get that to you. It might require a longer conversation on that. My final question, Madam Chair, in terms of the bill itself, and this would be either for Ms. Baum or Representative Hansen, but it seems as if the bill gives greater deference to the families involved in the child protection system. And obviously, we want to honor those wishes as well. But I am a bit troubled by, confused by, in the setting where a child is at risk, and you're suggesting that they collaborate with the family at the time of an outplacement or finding a safe and secure place for the child. It seems like there's a contradiction there between speaking with the same people who might be putting the child at risk and the best interests of the child themselves. So help me understand how that collaboration with the family works.
Rep. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. That's an important question. And what I'd like to say is I'd like to stand up for social workers and caseworkers everywhere where we do have extensive training in how to do the right thing and how to work alongside families, because family preservation is and should always be the goal, because that's the type of rehabilitation and supportive services that a person-centered approach takes. And so I will, you know, encourage folks to, you know, look at the values and ethics of the people who do this work. They are the glues of society that hold a lot of us together. And I think it's important to honor that their decision-making and the best practices that they follow are there. I don't know if Ms. Tice would like to also comment on that question, but I think this is a question we learn a lot in our training as we go through these procedures. So these are decisions that are not made lightly or with blanket decisions. They are individualized case plans. And each family is going to have unique needs, and each child will have unique needs. And there is a value that is placed on hearing from the child's family first. And with that, I would open it up to any other commenters who would like to comment on that.
Thank you, Rep. Hansen. Thank you, Rep. Albright, it sounds like this will get more questions in judiciary as well. So I encourage Representative Albright to contact Rep. Hansen and maybe work offline. We have three more people with questions, and then we'll move on. Representative Sandell.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I appreciate your comments in caucus yesterday, and I thought your presentation today was terrific. I agree with Representative Albright about how important this bill is. I have three quick questions because I know so little about the topic. One is there a pattern in the reasons that children are most frequently caused to leave their family? Is there a pattern in the ages at which the young kids are taken away from their family? And my third question is, once removed from a family, their birth family anyway, do the birth parents have a chance, or what is the relationship between the birth parents and the children while they're placed with another family? Thanks, and good luck on this great effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandell. I'm going to go to Rep. Hansen or Ms. Baum from DHS.
Chair Schultz, I would love to defer to Ms. Graham on this.
Ms. Baum, can you answer Representative Sandell's three questions?
Good morning, Representative Schultz. I'll take this one.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Sommerfeld, please proceed.
Thank you. So I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld from the Department of Human Services, and I will probably, Representative Sandell, have to ask you to repeat your questions just to make sure I'm covering them all. It's my recollection from recent data that one of the primary reasons that people are reported to child protection is neglect. But what I can do after this hearing, and I think we already are putting it together for a hearing that took place the other day, I will send the committee links to our current most recent out-of-home placement and maltreatment reports that provides a great deal of data on that area.
Representative Sandell, would you like to repeat the other two questions?
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much. My questions are just because I know so little bit about a little of the issue. The besides the reasons that children are removed, is there a pattern to ages? Are very young children more frequently removed from home, or is it older kids? And the other question is, once with a placement family, does the birth family have opportunities or a chance to meet and spend time with the child?
Ms. Sommerfeld?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Sandell. Members, I do not have any data with me today on the ages, but we do have that same data included in our out-of-home placement or our maltreatment report. So we will provide that to the committee, and I'll break out in an email, make sure we break out the pieces of information that are specific to your questions so that you don't need to read through the entire report to locate them. I'm not an expert in the field, so I'll say this is my understanding of how this works. I think when children are removed from their home, they're involved with their parents is probably case specific, right? We have cases where children have visitation with their parents. I don't know if that happens in every case, but I think that's more of a case by case basis decision on how that involvement goes. And while I have the floor, I'll really quickly clarify that this bill is policy only. It does not have a cost. So I thought I'd make sure that that question was answered right now, if I can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld, and thank you, Rep. Sandell. It sounds like they're going to get you the information that you seek. I think Representative Moeller wants to respond to Representative Albright, so we'll go to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just really quickly, I wanted to respond to the comment about the diligent efforts made, that was somehow new language, and there are a couple of paragraphs where that word diligent is added, but I was looking back at the bill and it's already in statute at lines 13.4, 19.9, 19.11, and 40.30, I believe. So that's not a new concept. He still asked a great question, and we'll be looking forward to seeing this bill in the Judiciary Committee where that can be followed up on. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Mulder. And it sounds like Rep. Pinto may also want to comment on Rep. Albright's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do, but sort of from a different angle. Just this is mostly just my own thinking to share that I feel my understanding from an early childhood perspective, I think the youngest kids are those who are most likely to be removed and the most physically at risk. And that the relationship with the family, Representative Albright and colleagues, I think the research shows is incredibly important, even in a situation where it may be a pretty challenging situation. As Ms. Sommerfeld said, Often kids are removed because of neglect as opposed to abuse, but even in an abusive situation, that bond with the family is so incredibly important. And I think it fits our intuition that birth families should have a real stake and a say in what goes on with kids from the rights of the parent perspective. But even if all you care about is what is going to be best for that individual child, and I'll say that for me, that's incredibly important. The research shows that the relationship with that birth family and the input from the birth family actually is really, really important in terms of the welfare of the individual child as well. So I really appreciate this this bill moving forward from that perspective. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you for sharing your expertise, Rep. Pinto. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. As you might imagine, I'm concerned about the emergency placement provisions and the diligent searches that can be done Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, through the working social workers. I understand, having been involved in numerous emergency removals of children in the past, I'm concerned about some of the provisions coming up and the risks that are taking. What position are we putting these officers that are on the scene at 2 o'clock in the morning on a weekend, that they're going to be placing that child in a situation that is safe? Not knowing the dynamics of the household and who lives there in the background, what provisions are there going to be to make sure that these officers aren't going to be unknowingly placing children in a situation that's no better or worse than they are removing them from?
Representative Hansen, would you like to respond?
I think it's a really valid question, Madam Chair, and Representative Novotny. I know that you have shared a personal experience from your community. And I think that's really valid because the stories of these kids are their life stories. So I would defer for the specifics about your policy question to go to Ms. Baum, but I just wanna acknowledge the importance of it and that this is not something that is taken lightly. And you're right, there are really hard decisions that have to be made at really hard times. So.
Ms. Baum or Ms. Sommerfeld like to respond to Representative Novotny's question. Ms. Sommerfeld?
Madam Chair, I believe Heidi Ambisa-Scallet from our staff at CSP is going to speak to this. And also I will add that this is one of the issues that Ms. Tice raised from the county perspective. So we are going to continue doing some work on this particular portion of the language. But if Heidi is available, she should be able, Ms. Ambisa-Scallet is available, she should be able to answer a little more specifically about the policy.
Okay, I didn't get your last name, Ms. Skyle. If you're here, introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Yes, so my name is Heidi Ambisa-Scallet, and I am the Adoption and Kinship Policy Specialist at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I can help address this question. So currently in the state law, what it says is that the peace officer at the time of, you know, taking the child into the custody, that they are to notify the parent or custodian that they can request that the child be placed with a relative or a designated caregiver under Chapter 257A rather than in a shelter care facility. So what this proposed language would do is it would then require the peace officer to ask the parent or custodian, and then it also adds the child if appropriate, if they would like to make that request. And if they do then make the request, that they, you know, the peace officer would honor that request. And the purpose around that is to help the child feel that they are in a place where they know the person, they are comfortable being there, but it does not require the peace officer to then place the child in a home if, you know, after they are able to locate, if they get the address, if they get the name, and they go to the home and they are unable to determine whether it is safe, then it's not requiring that the peace officer leave them there, because we also don't want to remove a child from an unsafe situation and then place them in a new unsafe situation. So there is the ability for the peace officer to determine that there could be a safety risk, and then either take the child to the home of a different relative or designated caregiver if there is one that was named and they are available, And then if there is no relative or designated caregiver available, that the peace officer would then take the child to a shelter care facility. So the purpose around it, again, is just to try to maintain some sense of normalcy, I guess, or, you know, comfort so that the child, we can kind of minimize that trauma of the removal in the first place.
Thank you, Ms. Scallet. Representative Otney, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. And that gets to my concern. Representative Hansen, you indicated that social workers have a lot of experience and training in this, and peace officers, I like to describe them as jack of all trades, masters of none. You're putting even more responsibility on them, and you're asking them to see into the future and make a prediction about what's going on, like I said, in the dark of the night with little access. And I understand that the welfare of the child is the most important thing, but keep in mind that, you know, we're not going into a home. The fact that we're there involved in emergency removal indicates in most cases that the child has already been traumatized and we need to get stabilized first. And I'll wrap just by saying that, you know, if this is a first aid situation, we need to stop the bleeding before we can worry about physical therapy. So with that, thank you for bringing the bill forward. As always, the welfare of the child is the most important to me, and that's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Otney. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, again, I think Representative Novotny's point is well taken. I guess my concern, having gone through the system of becoming a licensed foster care provider in the state of Minnesota and knowing the standards that are really held to somebody who is taking care of somebody, that's the responsibility of the state because that child's been removed. You know, I appreciate Rep. Hansen's goal here of reducing that trauma on the child, and I think that that's a lofty goal. It's certainly something we want to minimize the impact, and all of these things are happening. But again, looking at or having gone through that process, there's some minimum standards that are required, and I guess, you know, from basic things like having to have a fire extinguisher in my home or having to have my hot water heater temperature turned down so a child can't burn themselves, the long and extensive process that the interviews and the, you know, of each of my family members, the standards that we have for that, in contrast to, I guess I want to know what our minimum standards here are for placing a child in these types of situations. And again, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward because I do recognize the reduction in the trauma for the child who, you know, through no fault of their own is having to go through an extremely grueling situation. And unfortunately, I just want to make sure we're, because again, they're wards of the state in a way. I mean, they're being taken care of by the state at that point, and we're responsible for them. So I want to make sure we're doing our due diligence there.
Thank you, Representative Pearson. Representative Hansen, if you want to respond and say some last words about the bill, and then we'll move to a roll call vote. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you. And Representative Pearson, I think that's important. I'll send you a follow-up email as well to address your question. And in closing, members, I just want to say thank you. I know this is a big lift. It is a lot of work to make sure we're reducing disparities and doing what's best for our kids. And at the end of the day, regardless of what letters behind our name or which way we vote, like I've said before, this is a nonpartisan issue and kids need us to step up and do the right thing. And so I'm really proud to get to serve on this committee with you all. I'm really proud that you all have such a commitment to the future of our kids, especially those who are most vulnerable. So thank you again. And with that, Madam Chair, I turn it back to you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I know you will work well with the counties and others and other legislators to work on this bill to address their concerns as it moves to judiciary. So thank you. I know your heart is in the right place. And I'm confident you can work on the language to appease the counties and others. So with that, members, we're going to take a roll call vote. Ms. Hansen, chair votes aye. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 3380 to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. And the chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Yes.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Thank you. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher? One second. Well, Chair Schultz, that's 18 ayes and one excused.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Okay, the next bill we have before us is House File 1754, and the motion will be to lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Frederick, I believe this is the continuing care for older adults technical policy bill that we heard last year, and it sounds like you have an amendment. Would you like to make a motion to amend House File 1754 with the A22 amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, this is a voice vote. Please unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the amendment to House File 1754, this is the A22 amendment. Is that the correct amendment number, Yingya, Ms. Fang?
It will be A22-0325 because Thank there you. Are two A22.
Okay, I'm amendments. Sorry, members. This is the A22-0325 amendment. All those in favor of adopting this amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Frederick, please explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. As the chair pointed out, this bill we heard last year. And so the amendment I'll kind of focus on describing. What it does is in the omnibus last year, we said that remote day services were something that could be continued during the pandemic. But the feedback that the department has gotten and I've gotten as well is that they want to be able to continue this, that different providers throughout the state want to be able to provide remote day services going forward, even after we get past this pandemic. It's not going to be just remote. It's going to be in addition to. And so I think that is a good thing as we see. And I think there's going to be other things like it that we see going forward and more people offering more tele everything. And this is just one of those things. So I guess with that, I would turn it over to the department for any comments.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. We have available to answer questions, members from DHS. And I'm not sure, do we have any testifiers here? I know we have a long list of folks that can answer questions. I'm seeing just folks that can answer questions. So let's go to questions. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Liebling was first.
Oh, sorry, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. It would have been fine for you to go first. But anyway, I just wondered if someone from DHS could just give us an example of what this looks like. I have trouble just kind of seeing in my head what we're talking about here when we do these services remotely. I'm not quibbling with it. I just would really like to have a better mental picture if someone could provide that. Thank you.
Looks like Ms. Stockert has appeared. Ms. Stockert?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Liebling for your question. Nicole Stockert with the Department of Human Services. Representative Liebling, that's a very good question. This is actually a continuation of a waiver that we put in place for it was a COVID waiver. And so what happened was this is services that they can basically provide remotely without having to go into the center for services. So this would be things like socialization, activities. You can connect with your caregiver. This is intended to be an interactive two-way with audio and video. So it's not something where you can just, send a text. But there's actually quite a few services that can be provided remotely, and they have been quite successful in providing flexibility to these providers throughout the pandemic. And we'd be happy to get you some more examples of success stories that have been very helpful throughout the pandemic.
Thank you, Ms. Docker. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, so I'm going to let other members have the floor to ask their questions too, but I wonder then how we evaluate the effectiveness of this as compared to on-site services, because I mean, we know that for our kids, for example, people are saying all the time that doing remote learning, while it's not, it has value, it's not the same. There's a socialization piece that's missing, for example. And so anyway, I just still am kind of lacking a full understanding of how this can really be a substitute. And I understand it's not meant to be a complete substitute, but there's still a little missing piece for me, but I'm going to let other members have the floor and ask their questions too. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am going to springboard from what Representative Liebling said. I understand that some of this intention is to connect with individuals more expediently, more effectively. And so my first question to either Representative Frederick or the representative from DHS is this intentioned to locate or provide for cost savings to the program, or is it for other intentions? And with that, is there the propensity in any way, shape, or form that there might be fraud involved, or the lack of transparency for the services offered? We've often said that this is a very difficult time to deal with certain behavioral issues and of the mental health variety in a two-dimensional world. So how can we feel competent to provide those services or notice changes in the behavior of individuals when we're dealing remotely, as opposed to, as I think Representative Liebling suggested, that in some cases it is incredibly beneficial to be in person and maybe just for routine, but to observe other situations that might not come to the fore if you're just, in a Brady Bunch call.
I think we have Assistant Commissioner Pollack that may, or Representative Frederick, you want to tackle that first?
Oh, yep, I'll defer to Representative Frederick.
Madam Chair, if I can just put something in here real quick.
Yep.
If you were to go like 6 to 8 blocks directly behind me, there was a building that worked for or the building that was occupied by an organization called MRCI here in Mankato. And it was a facility designed for day programming for individuals with varying levels of disabilities. And they would come together, as Ms. Stockert would talk about, from a socialization aspect. But there's also skills training and other opportunities there for these individuals. And what we saw during the pandemic is that, and even prior to the pandemic, sometimes mobility was an issue just to get some of these, depending on each person's situation, physically there. And so part of this amendment language would say that these services can continue to be remote as long as there's like a two-way video to try to encourage that socialization aspect in specific cases. To Representative Albright's point of being in person, yes, I think everyone can be on board and being supportive of that and say, yes, if that is available, if the person has the capability of getting there, if they don't have their own challenges, we want to make sure that we can be as responsive to the individual cases as possible. So having the option for being remote, I think, is what is the goal of the amendment.
Assistant Commissioner Pollack, would you like to add anything to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick said it well. I just would draw Representative Albright's attention to page 4 of the amendment. It's actually the 0326 amendment. But that delineates some of the licensing requirements that this bill is imposing on remote day providers. And like Representative Frederick said, this is a voluntary option that really has during the pandemic, I think, helped to fill some of the gaps and the needs as we've lost a tremendous number of providers, unfortunately, in this space. So it's really something that is a good option for people. It's not required for them, and it does give, some benefit.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I'm a bit confused, and either for Mr. Pollack or Representative Frederick, but the way that I read the bill and as amended, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the bill specifically prohibit services whose main purpose is socialization?
Representative Frederick or Assistant Commissioner?
Madam Chair,
do you have a line number, Representative Albright?
I'm rifling through the pages, Madam Chair, and as soon as I find it, I'll bop in.
Madam Chair, I think the point is to offer remote day services as part of their care plan, and so there's a minimum in-person requirement that's quarterly. This is a licensed service, so they're subject to OIG oversight, and this service is provided to the person, as part of a care plan that they've received from their county caseworker.
Okay, Representative Albright, should we come back to you, Representative Albright?
I'm looking for it.
Okay, let's go to Representative Mueller while you look for that.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I remember when we were talking about the waiver for this during the COVID, when we were dealing with COVID and talking to one of my day providers and hearing that they actually had some folks who that really benefited from the remote, like people who had a lot of anxiety about being around other people, that this was useful for them to do this remote setting. And so I'm really excited about this bill because I think it really helps people who want to be in person, but then also those who it might work better for them to receive these services remotely. It's kind of like what we're doing in the business community too. People are really learning the things that worked well maybe during the pandemic. There were many things that didn't, but some of the benefits and things that worked well, trying to implement those moving forward in the business community. I think it's the same kind of thing for this. For some folks, this might actually work better. And so I'm really excited that this opportunity is out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative Albright.
Still looking, so
okay.
I'll take my hand down.
Okay, we'll go to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick. I think this can work well, but I'm just very concerned for families who want the in-person that their provider will kind of, almost forced them into the teleservices. During COVID, I had so many complaints from constituents, especially of adult people with disabilities who felt like they were just left out in the cold and now, even now, are not getting in-person services. And it's just been incredibly frustrating and in some cases dangerous. People have acted out and been harmful. So I just want to have on the record that this is completely voluntary and completely patient choice.
Thank you for that comment, Ms. Representative Robbins.
Can you speak to that? Is it very clear that this is only if the client wants it to be remote?
Assistant Commissioner or Representative Frederick?
I will say that in a lot of these decisions, it's not up to just any one person. There can be treatment teams of people involved in depending on the situation. I know in some cases too, people can decide one day that they want to attend things virtually and the next because of whatever might be going on in their lives. And the next time they may be able to choose to be in person. It should be a collaborative thing. There's part of me that wants to differentiate between some of the decisions that were made specifically during the pandemic that I can't speak to any, you know, one organization's choice of why they, you know, may have, you know, shut down or moved to everyone being remote. That could have been a choice that they made because they wanted to be what they felt was in the best interest of everybody. But kind of looking forward to what this bill is doing is just saying that they want to be able to have that option and how individual providers, you know, operate. Again, it's a focus on being in person as much as possible. But again, that could be different in every individual case, because we're talking, I mean, as we all know, right, when it comes to disabilities, there is a very wide range of how that presents. And so I don't want to like say it's going to be just, you know, black and white, but as much as possible, I think everyone can agree that it can be a good thing to be in person. But this would just be an option that would be available.
So just to clarify,
Representative Robbins,
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, is it the patient choice to participate remotely, or is it the provider choice?
Representative Frederick?
You know, I'm just going to say let's have the department weigh in here.
Sure. Assistant Commissioner Pollack.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, so it is the participant's choice. That's on line 4.14. But I just want to add, this industry has really gotten hammered. We've lost 50% of the provider capacity. So there may be large parts of the state where if you decline the remote adult day service, there may not be anything even close to you. So, you know, we need to acknowledge that. That's part of this. I'm sure, you know, Chair's already talked about the restoring the workforce and rebuilding, you know, these industries that got wiped out as part of the committee's work. But this bill that's in front of you gives the option of remote adult day to continue. Without this bill, we have to turn this off. We wouldn't even be able to offer this option into the future.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Robbins?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Deputy Commissioner as well as the representative. Reference to line 2.24, which defines adult daycare services by reference to 245A.02, which does not include socialization, and I'll read from that section. Adult daycare, adult day services, and family adult day services do not include programs where adults gather or congregate primarily for purposes of socialization, education, supervision, caregiver respite, religious expression, exercise, or nutritious meals. So I think there's going to be some necessary modification to this as you move forward, because you're contradicting your presentation contradicts what's in statute.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Albright. Assistant Commissioner Pollack, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, you're referencing their underlying licensure requirements, and so that is correct. An adult day program cannot be primarily for the purpose of socialization or the other items that are delineated in 245A.02. Those would be, if that was the only thing that they were doing, then that would not qualify as adult day. And that would be something that the licensing authorities would be asking the provider to document.
Thank you for that. Representative Albright, any final follow-up?
Just in response to the Deputy Commissioner, the conversation, the presentation of this bill was heavily weighted towards the socialization aspect. And I understand that your representation of the licensure certainly dictates for other services to be provided at the same time. But when a bill is represented in such a fashion that telehealth is intended to provide for that very specific point of being licensed to provide, I think you've got a problem. And so I would hope that Representative Frederick would undergo a consideration of either modifying his bill or undertaking an amendment to statute to remedy that situation.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I do hear some concerns, and I'm confident Representative Frederick and the agency can work with our legislators and reminding people that this bill will be laid over, so you do have time to work on it. Representative Albright, your hand is up again.
Just stretching.
Okay. Okay, Representative Frederick, final words. Oh, you know, before you do that, I made a mistake in the amendment number. So I have to make a new motion to unamend House File 1754 with the A22-0325 and amend it with the correct amendment, which is the A22-0326. So we'll have to redo the voice vote. So all in favor of the motion that I just stated, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and that amendment, the A22-0326, is adopted. And we have unamended House File 1754 with the A22-0325. Okay, Representative Frederick, two final comments on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, everyone, for the discussion. I know that we talked about socialization a lot, but I would also say that even when we're having committees, the time before and after, you know, there's people that are hanging around and we're having a conversation there. And so the socialization is a part, but I wouldn't say that's the primary focus. There is a lot of skills building. And I think that giving providers options such as remote remote options are a good thing. I think that, as was pointed out too, if we don't give some providers these options, then some people may not have any option, period. So I would just thank everyone for their support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. So the motion is to lay House File 1754 as amended over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, members. Next, we have House File 1432. This is for information only. This is the Vulnerable Adults Act redesign policy that we heard in committee last year. This bill is currently still in judiciary. So we'll take official actions when it comes back to our committee. So Representative Frederick, this is again your bill and you do have an amendment, the A22-0325, if you want to explain that.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill we heard last year kind of focuses on redesigning the Vulnerable Adult Act. It's been about 40 years since it's been touched. And so it brings it up to the current time frame. And what we know is that when it was written 40 years ago, the focus was kind of in congregate living facilities in that it had a heavy focus on people that were receiving care somewhere. And that if someone who was taking care of them was, you know, whether it's financial exploitation, abuse, or neglect. And this bill then kind of focuses on what has happened, what we've learned in the last few years, that self-care is a very real thing that kind of has come to the forefront of the conversations in the last few years, and that people who are living alone by themselves are not, because of the pandemic, because of that isolation, are not necessarily taking care of themselves as well as we would hope they would. And so this helps counties and enables them to be able to provide help and services, however that is appropriate. In the amendment that is being offered, looks at when allegations of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation are made, how we go about making some of these investigations. And we want to make sure that all Minnesotans, regardless of race, ethnicity, any of it, get the attention needed when there is an allegation. And it doesn't. So right now, if someone, another piece of the bill is actually when there is a report of maltreatment, that it used to be that the individual counties could set up a reporting number. But if you had one worker that maybe worked in two or three counties, you might have to learn two or three different ways to make that report of maltreatment. And so this bill would actually make it one standardized process that they call the centralized reporting line, saying, hey, share the story. And so the new process then would be that the state, that centralized reporting line gets the report. They do a screening process, screen in the report or screen out the report if there's not enough information, whatever that reason may be. And then from there, if they screen in the report for an investigation, it goes down to the counties. The counties then will get that. Then they can do their own screening of, yes, they are going to conduct an investigation, or no, they are not going to conduct an investigation. And right now, looking at the numbers, when it gets to that county level, If the vulnerable adult is white or Caucasian, then more than 40% of the time, there is going to be an investigation. If that vulnerable adult is Black or African-American, then you're talking around like 20% of the time there's an investigation that gets conducted. And so while the amendment doesn't want to eliminate the county's ability to do this screening process, what we do, what the hope is anyways, is that we can standardize that process to try to close some of that disparity.
Thank you for that explanation. We also have Ms. McGurran, I believe, from the agency, if you want to add to any explanation of the amendment before us.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Yes, we have a informational PowerPoint that Nicole Stockard is lining up here, and we'll just walk through a little bit of foundational information here. So I'm Mary McGurran, and I'm a licensed social worker and the supervisor for adult protection here at the Department of Human Services. So first, let's talk about what is the Vulnerable Adult Act, or the VAA. At the highest level, the Vulnerable Adult Act establishes state policy for the protection of adults who are especially vulnerable to abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation because they receive services licensed by the Department of Health or the Department of Human Services, or because they're an older adult with an impairment or a person with a disability living in the community and they're not able to do what's necessary to maintain their own health. The Vulnerable Adult also creates the centralized system for mandated reporters and the public to report suspected maltreatment. And that's the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center operated by the Department of Human Services. The Vulnerable Adult Act also identifies which agency is responsible to respond to reports of suspected vulnerable adult maltreatment for the protection of the vulnerable adult. And if the person isn't receiving services that are licensed by DHS or the health department, the county is responsible for adult protective services. Next slide. So this slide shows, in addition to defining who a vulnerable adult is, the Vulnerable Adult Act establishes categories and definitions of maltreatment. And each of these types of maltreatment has a detailed definition under the Vulnerable Adult Act. Next slide. In Minnesota, like the rest of our human services system, we have a county-administered adult protection system. This contrasts with the majority of states who have state-administered protection systems. As you can see in the diagram, the county-administered protection system has a dual role, those green boxes at the bottom under the county side, for emergency adult protective services, or that's when DHS or MDH are also responsible for the report. The county is also responsible for the protection of the person. And the county is the only lead investigative agency under the Vulnerable Adult Act whose role is both to investigate the person alleged responsible and also to engage the person that they investigated, often the vulnerable adult or family caregiver, in protective services. And APS's dual roles can be in conflict with an outcome to both investigate and also then engage the same person in services to stop the maltreatment and reduce risk of reoccurrence. Next slide. So media and other coverage is often about vulnerable adults in long-term care facilities or services licensed by the health department or the Department of Human Services. But as you can see here in this 2019 and 2020 data from the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, that Minnesota counties are responsible for responding to more vulnerable adults that have been reported as experiencing maltreatment than both the health department and DHS combined. Next slide. So the Vulnerable Adult Act historically was established in the 80s without funding for adult protective services. And county-administered adult protection relies heavily on county funds for operating this program that provides critical protection for vulnerable adults living in their own homes or in the community. For tribal nations, there is no dedicated state or federal funding. In 2012 and again in 2019, the legislature added partial state funding for county-delivered adult protection. And then in 2021, the first ever federal funding dedicated to adult protection came through the Administration for Community Living through the COVID relief bill. So this was groundbreaking for adult protection. And next slide. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the redesign and the bill and amendment. Next slide. As many of you know, DHS is leading a redesign process to update and modernize the Vulnerable Adult Act for Adult Protective Services. And a group of more than 260 stakeholders have been involved in this process. And again, I'll emphasize from the slide with the colored bubbles, this is focusing on county-delivered adult protection. And what we heard from stakeholders, those 260 stakeholders, was that our adult protection system lacks statewide consistency. And I think this is what Representative Frederick was referring to, that vulnerable adults receive a different response depending on the county responsible for that report and response. We also heard from stakeholders that we need to shift the balance from focusing on investigation and blame of the person responsible to a person-centered assessment and engagement with the vulnerable adult and their support persons, and have an outcome that focuses on safety and dignity and preventing maltreatment or maltreatment reoccurrence. We also heard from stakeholders that they value privacy for the vulnerable adult, but that there is a necessity to allow data sharing or information sharing for coordination to increase that person's safety. And we also heard from stakeholders that the lack of a stable funding system contributes to inequities across the state in the service response that's received. So we've been working with our partners to develop a more person-centered, equity-based adult protection system by redesigning the role of adult protective services under the Vulnerable Adult Act. And House File 1432 aligns with these changes. Next slide. So what's included in 1432, you may remember when we presented this bill last year in this committee, and as Representative Frederick mentioned earlier, this bill is the first phase of the Vulnerable Adult Act redesign. It's part of a multi-year collaboration and coordinated effort to develop policy changes that support statewide consistency and equity for safety, dignity, and service outcomes for vulnerable adults. Above are some of the outcomes from the Vulnerable Adult Act Phase 1, and we anticipate bringing a funding request forward in the next phase of the redesign. But a few of the highlights from this bill are that it improves clarity for county adult protective services to share information with other agencies, guardians, and healthcare agents, not only for investigation of the allegation, but also for protection of the person. And that's a significant change. And we also add that counties must make their guidelines for accepting vulnerable adult reports for adult protective services available to the public. And this will add consistency and transparency so that vulnerable adults and their families and support persons know how to understand which reports may meet the county's threshold for services and investigation, and help vulnerable adults and their families and supporters understand why some reports are not accepted or that's sometimes referred to as screened out. Next slide. So the amendment also aligns with the Vulnerable Adult Act redesign, and it has some primary points to supporting county authority to share data for the purpose of protection of the vulnerable adults with tribal nations when the vulnerable adult is a tribal member, and with case managers when the vulnerable adult has a case manager. It also allows county agencies to offer assistance to the reporter or to the person who was reported when the report is not accepted or is screened out for adult protective services or investigation. And ultimately, the amendment emphasizes assessing the person and the incident and using that information to create a safety plan and engage the individuals in protective service interventions rather than focusing on investigations. Service interventions stop and reduce risk of maltreatment, which will improve outcomes for vulnerable adults. As this will change the focus from investigation of who is responsible to the maltreatment when there's an informal caregiver or families or a family caregiver, and really helps support the family and support the vulnerable person to getting help and getting connected to services, which is going to lead to a person-centered outcome for them. And next slide. Nicole Stockert is here, and her contact information is listed here if you have further questions.
Thank you, Ms. McGurran, for that presentation. So with that, members, we also have a bill that is related to House File 1432, which is Representative Knorr's bill. It does not yet have a bill number, but Representative Knorr, this is the funding bill that goes with the adult protections. Do you want to quickly discuss your upcoming bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. As you've already noted, thank you so much for the informational hearing on this proposal and very important set of issues. This proposal complements the adult protection bill you just had. I want to thank Representative Frederick and the department for the presentation and also continuing on this discussion, and various county organizations for bringing forward and supporting phase one of change for adult protection system in Minnesota. As you heard, adult protective services are essential for Minnesotans because they respond when older and vulnerable adults living at home or in the community are at the risk of financial exploitation, emotional and physical abuse, or neglect. These are complex cases, and APS workers must have a variety of social work tools at their disposal to ensure that the adult is protected, treated with dignity and respect, and provided with comprehensive next steps to help prevent abuse from occurring again. Unfortunately, the funding mechanism for adult protection do not yield the result Minnesotans need. Unlike child protective services, there is no federal funding allocated for ongoing adult protection work. While there's a small amount of state grant funding available and used by counties, most of the spending in adult protective services fall directly on the county itself. This has made for patchwork system, depending on where vulnerable adults live in Minnesota. They may not receive the same services and intervention as those in similar situation in other parts of the state. Just a couple of months ago in December 2021, DHS briefed lawmakers on recent report they commissioned that showed how Minnesotans is far behind the rest of the country when it comes to cases accepted. There's a link online that gives you that data. On key takeaway on that is Minnesota only accepts 24% of eligible cases, while the national average is over 62%. That also shows that there's a screen out of 76% compared to 37% nationally. So especially for BIPOC communities or individuals with mental health issues or substance use disorder. So members, this bill will complement the department's phase one efforts by providing some much needed funding until further phases of the department plan come into fruition. It will, this bill as written right now, subdivision 1 and 4 create fund working group to help implement some of the recommendation from the DHS recently commissioned and produce these findings. Subdivision 2 provide one-time state funding for counties to help address caseload coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic and bridge us to the next budget cycle. Subdivision 3 funds pilot project for counties to develop new ways to address the inequities in the adult protection systems. I know the current grant funding mechanism in Subdivision 2 may need some technical tweaks, and I look forward continue to work with Representative Frederick and also the department and all stakeholders to make sure our adult protection system is funded and designed in a way that works for all Minnesota vulnerable. With that, Madam Chair, I have individuals who want to testify on this issue.
Okay, I'm going to give the testifier just 2 minutes. So let's see, we have Amanda Vikstrom with us. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Vikstrom. I'm the executive director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and we are a statewide nonprofit organization that provides support and advocacy services to victims of elder abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. We strongly support the funding proposals in Representative Knorr's bill. Since our founding in 2014, we've partnered with county APS agencies and DHS And we strongly encourage addressing these structural inequities within our APS systems so that APS can provide better protective and supportive services to vulnerable adults, many of whom are older adults living in their own homes and in the community. We know firsthand with our direct work with victims and their families that the public is either confused or unaware of the adult protection system and can be very frustrated when county APS declines to open a case. In July of 2021, when DHS released that evaluation report of the Adult Protective Services Standardized Intake Decision Tool, we really believe that's a call to action. And it tells us two important hard truths. First, Minnesota does lag behind the rest of the country in providing adult protective services to vulnerable adults. And on average, our APS system provides services to only 24% of the eligible vulnerable adults experiencing maltreatment. And that national average is at 62%. And second, two groups of vulnerable adults that are experiencing maltreatment are statistically more likely to be screened out of APS than any other group. And those are racial and ethnic minorities and persons with mental health issues, specifically chemical dependency. So what the report doesn't show is how that historic underfunding of county adult protection has really left our older and vulnerable adults behind. Without any significant state or federal funding, we really over-rely on county budgets to fulfill the mandates of the Vulnerable Adult Act. We applaud DHS's approach to a full-scale, multi-phased approach in updating Minnesota's APS system, as you heard in relation to HF 1432, but still we know that the significant updating to adult protection, including the changes called for in the report, cannot happen without additional resources. We believe the one-time funding put forward in this bill will help bridge the gap until the state budget is properly adjusted to support equitable provision of APS services. We look forward to working with the department, with you all as lawmakers and other stakeholders, to continue the redesign of APS so that the Vulnerable Adult Act works for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vikstrom. So with that, members, we'll be bringing back House File 1432 and Representative Knorr's bill to take formal action. And finally, members, we have one last bill on our agenda. This is House File 2818, and the motion is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Representative Rasmussen, I don't see an amendment. Would you like to explain your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Pioneer Care and its staff in Fergus Falls do great work providing nursing home services and other services to the aging loved ones in our broader community. I know personally, as my grandparents have spent time there, all of them, either as residents or volunteers. Pioneer Care, like the broader long-term care industry, is facing challenges due to staffing and other impacts from COVID. In fact, Pioneer Care was among the first facilities in the state to receive staffing support from the National Guard and has been at the forefront of discussions on the workforce crisis in long-term care. House File 2818 seeks to address Pioneer Care's particular situation of having the capital costs of a new facility while having missed the new property payment system that is currently used to reimburse new or upgraded facilities. The bill before the committee would allow Pioneer Care's nursing home to access the new property payment system, which more fairly compensates nursing homes that have made large property investments that improve the experience for staff and residents. The new property payment system was put in place in 2019. From that time on, any new projects approved through a moratorium exception get the new property rate system. Without this bill, Pioneer Care would need to seek a new project through the moratorium exception to get the new property rate system. Because Pioneer's nursing home was built brand new in 2010, there isn't necessarily a need to make any additional capital investments at this time. In the lifespan of a building, they basically have a brand new building. So the moratorium exception process is likely not the appropriate answer for Pioneer Care's unique situation. For these reasons, Madam Chair and members, we are seeking a limited legislative solution in this bill. Madam Chair, I have one testifier for the bill, Nathan Johnson, who serves as the administrator of Pioneer Care. I also have Jeff Bostick from Leading Age Minnesota, who is available to answer questions as needed.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Just please state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nathan Johnson. I'm a nursing home administrator. I'm the CEO at Pioneer Care up in Fergus Falls. And just for a point of clarification, Jeff Bostic did have to jump off the committee, I believe, to attend another meeting. So it's just me. But thank you, Representative Rassman, for that wonderful summary. Basically, that's the issue for us. I think I can just add a few comments of context and talk a little bit about the impact of the disparity that we feel in our property rate. We operate a 105-bed nursing home in Fergus Falls. We also operate assisted living dementia care facilities, 70 units in total. We operate independent living apartments, 44 units in total, and we operate home and community-based services that serve about 600 people in the surrounding area. We built the new nursing home in 2010, and by doing that, we made significant capital investment for our community to improve the experience for our residents and for our staff. We're very fortunate to have a beautiful building that's still very new. Unfortunately, we find ourselves with a very large disparity between our property rate and our capital costs, specifically depreciation and interest expense. I believe we may have one of the largest disparities in the state. I get that information from the most recent cost report comparison data provided by DHS. For example, our depreciation and interest expense on a per diem basis equals about $64.08. The 90th percentile for all other nursing homes in the state equals $34.79. So the takeaway from that is that our expenses in those two areas are basically about double the state's 90th percentile. So that translates into quite a bit of dollars for us. And just to put that in terms of dollars for our little nursing home, between depreciation and interest expense, we have about $1.8 million this year that we will expense. Our current property rate, which is $19.91 per patient day, provides us with about $700,000 in designated rate to cover those expenses. So this means we're diverting about $1.1 million from other resources to help us cover these capital costs, and doing so, of course, at a time when we're severely impacted by the workforce shortages and the consequent occupancy challenges. So this bill would seek to fix that disparity, and we would appreciate the help of this committee to see that through. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. Would this bill then necessitate that a new appraisal of the facility be completed prior to the new rate being calculated?
Mr. Johnson?
Yes, thank you for the question. That is my understanding. I've worked on this with Jeff Bostic at Leading Age Minnesota, who I suspect many of you know, and he assured me that it would require a new valuation of our nursing home.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the testifier, how soon can that appraisal be completed?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I don't have an answer for that, but I'd be happy to follow up on it, get back to the committee right away.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I see that the Deputy Commissioner for DHS is on the call. I'm wondering if he would be willing to respond to my questions, because I understand that there may be some delay in the payment to the facility based upon this appraisal. So certainly want to encourage Mr. Pollack to expedite that as soon as possible.
Commissioner Pollack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I think this is it's a related issue in the sense that this facility is definitely experiencing a variety of funding crises, and we acknowledge that. I think the issue in front of the committee is more about the process for how we normally do these kinds of applications with moratorium exception projects. So I can let some other DHS folks weigh in here as well if you want some technical feedback about this issue.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I'll just leave it in the capable hands of the commissioner to complete his work in a timely fashion, given the fact that that nursing home relies upon his work to stay in their beds and stay warm in a climate that does tend to be very, very cold this time of year.
I see that we have Val Cook with us. Val, Ms. Cook, would you like to respond?
Good morning, Madam Chair. I can respond technically to the question about timing of the appraisals.
Can you give your name and affiliation first, please?
Sure. Valerie Cook with the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at DHS. Regarding the technical question about timing of the appraisal, so the fair rental value system is relatively new. We are only a few months away from the first one to enter that system and have arranged for an appraisal. But to beyond that one appraisal, due to contracting procurement guidelines, we will need to issue a request for proposal to a competitive bid for an appraiser to do this work. And so, that will take a few months, and that's where we're at. So we don't currently have an appraisal system under contract that can immediately respond.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Representative Albright?
No more questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative, and thank you, Ms. Cook and Commissioner Pollack. Representative Rasmussen, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing on House File 2818 today. I hope we're able to address PioneerCare's unique situation by giving them access to the new property payment system and help them continue to serve our aging neighbors in West Central Minnesota. And look forward to working with you, Madam Chair, and DHS on this bill moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. So House File 2818 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance and policy omnibus bill. And members, just to make sure that this is clear, the motion was to lay over House File 1754 as amended for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill as well. Okay, members, we will be meeting on Thursday, and I'm not seeing any other questions or comments. So looking forward to discussing more bills with you tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.